Hello everyone and a warm welcome back to Footprints. This month we hear about how local writers have included the city of Bath and its surroundings in their work. It's the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth this year, and so for the first time we'll celebrate her work and hear about what's being planned for the celebrations this year. We'll also meet three local living writers whose work has all been inspired by living in the city. And we're delighted to be joined by Sam Drew from Mr. B's Bookshop, who'll give us a rundown of writers inspired by Bath. So let's get going with local historian David Williamson. I met him and other authors at an event organised by Bath Central Library to showcase local writers and small publishers. It was a very busy Saturday morning at the end of half term, and here he is telling me about his book, Bath Between the Wars. Obviously you talk about the Georgian architecture and you talk about the spa and tourism to Bath, but you also talk about the industrial centre of Bath. I don't think we usually think of Bath as an industrial centre. Tell me about that.
Well, it was in some ways a surprisingly important industrial centre. The big firm Stothard & Pitt exported huge cranes all over the world, the British Empire, but also beyond. There was one Bathonian who went to Australia and was very much teased by the Aussies about always talking about Bath, and then he just took them down to the railway siding and showed them a huge crane made by Stothard & Pitt. There was also a car firm, Horsemans, that could have taken off. It never did. It kept going bankrupt, but it ended up by making vital parts for tanks in the 30s, which the War Office approved of. So that was another example of a Bath industrial firm. So Bath also, therefore, Bath politics reflected the fact that it was torn between conservative majority, perhaps made up a lot of retired people, and working minority who voted Labour. And you did get eruptions like the general strike, the big 1930s recession. You got loud meetings taking place in Bath. So Bath was by no means a sort of genteel or exclusively a genteel place, but there was this big sort of Oldfield Park all along the Bristol Road, big industrial area and population, and of course the terrible slums in Avon Street. So it was a very, you know, by no means just a museum piece.
And how did all that change then between the wars?
Well, the slums came down, Avon Street came down, new council houses were built along Englishcombe Lane, three blocks of very modern flats were built in central Bath. Also, of course, you got buildings like the Forum, the new electricity shop, the new co-op, big co-op. And in the early 30s, Bath was really a mecca for work in the Great Recession, time of high unemployment. It was a mecca because there was so much building work going on. So Bath did change quite a lot like that. Although, of course, historic Bath, then as now, was still there, and the Bath Preservation Society fought valiantly and, on the whole, successfully to preserve it. That's a sort of thumbnail sketch of changes. Motorisation, of course. I mean, 1919, probably you'd say most traffic was horse-drawn, and the co-op, the minutes of the co-op society, the end of 1919, is about buying a new horse in Marshfield. Whereas if you go on to 38, 39, most of Bath was motorised. If you stood in the roads, it was quite rare to see a horse cart, though they still existed, but, you know, they were already marginalised.
Now, also in your book, I noticed a chapter intriguingly called The Bathwick Typhoid Outbreak. Mm. Tell me about that.
Well, in 1928, resulting from probably a burst drain coming from the golf course in Bathwick, typhoid epidemic developed, and it struck the inhabitants of Bathwick, and something like 20 people died. And Bath, the council, A, got off a very slow start identifying it, and B, when it was identified, they did everything they could to keep it from the press, and there were attempts by the council to buy up all the papers, the Morning Post and the Times, before locals could read it. And this, of course, backfired, and the Morning Post had a huge article, you know, called Hush Hush. But Bath's line was, understandably, commercially, that they didn't want to deter tourists.
David, you're a historian. Tell me about how you became a historian.
Well, I suppose I was born in 1940, and I suppose I grew up just at the end of the war, where there was always so much talk about what people did in the war and how, you know, in a sense, the drama, the pre-war years. You know, I used to hear my grandmother droning on about Edwardian times, that I was very, very interested in the past, you know, and then I was very lucky that I was able to study history at university and then teach it. So, you know, I was lucky that I could do what I, in my life, I've done what I wanted to do.
Now you're writing about it. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks to David Williamson, and we'll be returning to the library later. But next up is Georgia Delve, Festival Director at the Jane Austen Centre in Bath. And she's joined by Lauren Faulkner, who plays Lizzie Bennett in the guided tour of the centre. We're meeting in the Regency Tea Room at the top of the building. Lizzie, just let's start with you then. Can I call you Lizzie rather than Lauren? Because I think you are dressed up as Lizzie Bennett. We've just seen Mr. Wickham. He's just brought me a coffee. And Mr. Darcy is on the wall behind me. Lizzie, let's just start with Jane Austen and who she was and what her life was like.
So Jane Austen is obviously one of Bath's most famous residents here, but known mostly across the world as an amazing novelist. Her works have been translated into languages all across the world, and we have visitors here from all parts of it who love her works and what she's written. And of course, she lived here in Bath herself as well, between 1801 and 1805.
She certainly did, and she was born in 1775, which means that this is 250 years since that date. And later on, I'm going to ask you, Georgia, to talk about the festival, because you must be really ramping up for the celebration of that. So she lived here in Bath. That was with her parents, I think. So what was it like to be a woman writer at the beginning of the 19th century?
So Jane Austen came to live in Bath with her parents, and then sadly, of course, her father died while they were in the city. So then they moved a little bit down the pegging order in terms of accommodation, etc., while they were in the city, which we'll cover a little bit later, I think. But in terms of women writers at that period, there weren't actually that many around. Jane Austen herself published anonymously, so it was by a lady. So they knew that it was by a lady, but they didn't know who it was. And that was because, I mean, historians today, and this is, there are varying opinions on why, but she had family members that were quite high up in the, you know, there were people in the clergy, so maybe it wasn't thought so well that she would be a lady writing. And of course, she had her brother, Edward, who was also of high standing, a landowner with, you know, various properties. So she, you know, tried to hide that for a while. Of course, once she died, lots of her family, as we're seeing now in this Miss Austen TV series that's out, published their own autobiographies or biographies of her, little articles about her, or published letters that she'd written. So we got to see their version of her. But we don't know a lot about what happened to Jane Austen during her lifetime, other than what letters existed, left over, that her sister didn't destroy.
So she wasn't well known in her lifetime, is what you're telling me?
No, not too much, no. So Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility were published. Emma was published. And, of course, it's dedicated to the Prince Regent. And there is another film about it where they depict her going and meeting with his librarian, which is a very interesting little snippet. Whether that happened as it's portrayed or not, we don't know. But she was well enough known that dedication happened. How the mechanics of that came about, we will never know, I'm sure, but that happened. So they knew who she was at that point. But she never got the international recognition that she has today with all of our visitors to the centre and to the Jane Austen Festival.
So what brought her to Bath, Lizzie, and what, how did she feel about being here?
Well, the family were moved to Bath, and there are some records that they've found. A particular biography was published where they did say possibly she was quite surprised that they were going to be moved to Bath, and maybe wasn't her first reaction wasn't one of elation, because she loved living in the countryside and in Hampshire. And of course, when Edward Knight offered them her more wealthy adopted brother, he offered them two estates. She chose to go back to Hampshire, of course, which is now Chawton House, which is the Jane Austen Museum in Hampshire, of course, dedicated to her there. But I do think, personally, from reading a few biographies, and the fact that two of her novels are based here in Bath, both Persuasion, of course, and Northanger Abbey, and Bath is mentioned in the other novels as well, that as a writer, I think once she got into the swing of it and the social events, and she was a great dancer herself and enjoyed music and socialising, and of course she's renowned for being very observant of people and society, I actually think she loved her time in Bath. But it probably was a bit of a shock when first they were told they were going to move there. And of course their parents, they were married at St Swithin's Church, and so it had lovely memories for them, but maybe as young girls it wasn't necessarily the first place on the top of their list.
Georgia, which do you think she wrote first? Of the two that are set in Bath, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion, which do you think comes first?
So in terms of the content of the novels, I think Catherine Morland is much younger and she's at the start of her life and she's exploring Bath for the first time when she's introduced. So I think it would sit that she wrote and that novel first.
Can we just have a little précis of Northanger Abbey for the one or two listeners who've never read it?
So Northanger Abbey, I think, reflects a few elements of Jane Austen's life herself. She is the daughter of a clergyman. She is brought to Bath by some local friends of the family, and she's introduced into society of Bath. She goes to the assembly rooms in Bath, which, of course, we have today. We use regularly for the Jane Austen Festival events. You can walk around them and see them, etc. And then she has all her adventures in the city, falling in love, not falling in love, finding an unsuitable suitor. And then she goes off to this massive mansion, Northanger Abbey, which is the title of the book, obviously. And I won't spoil the ending, but, you know, that happens. Something happens there. There's definitely elements of gothicness in it as well, some dark. It's almost like a little bit of a mystery that Jane Austen's got going in it, which is maybe a little unusual compared to the rest of her novels. You don't really get that element. You suddenly have this questioning storyline within Northanger Abbey, which is never quite resolved. But yeah, I'll leave it there. But in terms of Bath, of course, Northanger Abbey is based in the city, so we have the assembly rooms. They know Great Pulteney Street. They stay on Great Pulteney Street, and it's a brilliant line about travelling down the length of Great Pulteney Street and then, of course, going out to see Blaise Castle, which is in Bristol. And they talk about going to see this amazing Gothic mansion castle that they really want to see. And, of course, now us locals, we know if you go and see Blaise Castle, it's a miniature three-turreted fake that was built. Somewhere else they visit is Beechen Cliff, which, of course, you can still walk up today, go up the back, and you get the beautiful panoramic view over the top of the train station and across. So that's another place that Jane Austen must have walked herself, because it's mentioned in the novel, so she would only know by being there. And yeah, so it's a lovely little playful novel set in Bath. On the flip side, you get Persuasion, which is the second one, the one that she wrote in her latter years of her life. And we know that because the heroine is older and she has already rejected the suitor, which happens before the book starts. And again, family circumstances. Her father is quite high up and wealthy, apart from he's not. And he retrenches by moving to Bath, which I think nowadays is quite ironic in terms of Bath. It's quite an expensive place to live and exist, and we're a very nice, affluent, lovely city here with all sorts of various diverse cultures happening in the city. But then he chose to move here to save money and live in the city. And so then the heroine is brought to Bath, and Elliot, along the way, she goes off on adventures of other places. We know that Jane Austen had been Lyme, visiting down that way in the country, along past the seafront, and it ends up back in the city of Bath again. They stay at the White Hart, which again is a real place in Bath that did exist then, and it overlooks the pump rooms. and the colonnade that's there.
We were mentioning that Persuasion was written a bit later in her life and the character is a little bit older, but also that it does address the different social classes in Persuasion. So she has a friend of hers who is on harder times and she's not very well, and Anne Elliot actually goes and visits her as well. And so it does address that idea that often Jane covers so nicely in her books, of the idea of it not being what your external look is or how affluent you are and how much money you have, but actually the person who's inside that is something that's really worthy and something that is really kind of rewarded in her books. And those people like Caroline Bingley, I would say, being Lizzie, who, you know, just think a lot about their looks and their social standing, aren't rewarded so much. Whereas all of her heroines, often after a little bit of effort, they get their happy ending.
But that's the beauty of Jane Austen, isn't it? She satirises the class structures of the day, but kind of gets underneath them and talks about what's very real for her, which is friendship and connection.
Yes, she addresses really serious subjects, and also obviously she's a female writer and she really addresses the way that women were treated in the period and also that some of the limited choices they have. And so she's an addressing a very serious subject, but she does it in such a witty and wonderful way that it was just accepted, and her books were hugely popular, you know, to men, women, everyone.
Tell me, Georgia, about Bath and how it was in her day, because, I mean, obviously there's been a huge amount of building since then, but where did she walk?
Yeah, so we know from one of her letters that she did a lovely walk out to Weston, and she describes it as going from, you know, from the Royal Crescent, which at that time would have been a standalone crescent in beautiful fields. You were, of course, having Marlborough Buildings that was just built on this going up the side of the Royal Crescent, but other than that there would have been nothing behind it. Victoria Park is of course Victorian, so didn't exist yet, and that would have just been beautiful fields and landscape. And as we know, she was a country girl at heart, so she wanted to get out there. So she did this beautiful walk all the way across to Weston, which was at that time a little village. Now it's an environ of Bath, it's been swallowed up by the city. So that's one way she used to go. Of course, I already mentioned Beecham Cliff, which would have been up the other side of the hill on the opposite side of the river. At that point when she was living here, the Royal Crescent was at the top of the town off to the left. And then the other little crescents, I think there's the 7 or the 9 of the little ones, including Camden Crescent, where Anne Elliot's father chose to live. They all sat in their own little bits of parkland up there. Of course, they're now all filled in between them. But at the time, it's sort of like thinking that there's little, almost like an amphitheatre. They created a giant amphitheatre in Bath by doing these crescent sort of giant seats going up this side of the hill. And then of course as you came down towards the water level, the quality of the air, because you think there would have been smoke from all the fires, there would have been no running toilets and things like that wouldn't have happened. So, and another interesting thing is that behind Marlborough Buildings, where the allotments are now, it used to be the toilet for where everyone's toilets would get emptied to. So when you grow your vegetables in Marlborough Buildings allotments, you've got great... I don't know if it lasts 250 years. But
no, I'm sure it has. That's a treat, isn't it? Thank you for telling us that. So Lizzie, just tell me your job, because you are dressed up beautifully to be Lizzie Bennet. Tell me your job.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. Obviously, if I was Lizzie, I'd say my sister Jane is much more beautiful than myself and the favourite of the family. She'll marry very well. But here at the centre, we have a very immersive experience, and we give a presentation at the beginning in character, telling everyone about Jane's life, her family history, but particularly her time here in Bath as well, and focusing the areas that her books are based and also the places she would have visited herself. And of course, she lived on Gay Street, where we have the centre here. And then in the exhibition itself, you can dress up in Regency costume. You can write with acrylic ink. And also there is our world famous Jane Austen waxwork as well.
Georgia, it's 250 years since she was born. You must have a lot planned. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so my role as festival director is, so we have our annual Jane Austen Festival in Bath that takes place every September. It's 10 days long. It started off 25 years ago in 2001 with a long weekend of events. It's now the full 10 days, which is amazing. And we get to work with loads of different businesses and places in Bath. So we use, I already mentioned, the assembly rooms. We always go, of course, to the pump rooms where Jane Austen also went. We always have had a summer ball as well, just to catch those summer visitors to the city of Bath. This year, instead of just having one, we're having two to accommodate all of the Jane Austen fans that want to visit the UK in 2025.
So what can people look forward to?
So, of course, we always open the festival with our world-famous promenade. This year it will start from the Royal Crescent and it will come a little bit down a little bit of Gay Street, then down Milsom Street, go down the centre of town and end in Parade Gardens. 2024, we had 1,270 people take part in that. They all support the running of it because obviously we have to close roads, pay for safety measures, etc., things like that, keep everyone safe. But it's, 1,270 people in costume walking through the streets of Bath. We've got musicians, soldiers, and everyone wears their best outfits, which is lovely. During the rest of the festival, we have Regency balls where people can come and feel like they're dancing in the footsteps of Catherine Morland in Northanger Abbey, for instance. We have croquet. We partner with Bath Croquet Club to talk about that. We have the Jane Austen Dancers of Bath here, of course, that always have weekly classes, but they come along and they teach people how to dance for the week. They have daily dance workshops. Theatricals, musicals, concerts in the evenings. There's always something for everyone every day. The idea is that they can probably go on a walk. They can probably do a workshop and learn something hands-on from the Regency period. They can probably listen to somebody talking and they can probably spend their evening luxuriating in the world of the Regency, which is great.
Wow, so you could come for the whole 10 days.
Oh, yes, people do. Yes, yeah. We have hardcore people that come, not hardcore, wonderful Jane Austen fans that we absolutely adore and love. And we see one of the great things about the festival is the sense of community. So although we have people coming from all over the world, some have been coming for many years. This will be their 10th, 11th, 15th festival. Then, of course, we have new people coming into the mix and they all meet and combine into this melting pot of Regency-ness and Jane Austen's world. But I love seeing the faces come back again. And some come for the first weekend to take part in the promenade and be part of that, you know, world record numbers every year. And then some come for the full 10 days and they have a different costume for every day. They'll have a daytime outfit and they'll have an evening outfit if they're going out. So a lot of our events, particularly the ones in, say, the pump rooms or the Roman baths or the balls, they are costumes. People have to wear costume when they come. Regency outfits, of course, as Jane Austen would have herself worn, or Mr. Darcy, etc. And then some people decide that they prefer the talks and the hands-on element, but maybe not the outfits. So there's always something for everybody to try out.
Oh, so lots to look forward to. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful to see you.
Lovely to meet you. Thank you.
And the festival this year takes place from the 12th to the 21st of September, and you can find out all about it and the summer balls on their website. Details are in the show notes. So let's return to the library now and hear from another writer. Here she is to introduce herself.
I'm J.F. Penn, you can call me Jo, and I write thrillers, dark fantasy, memoir, as well as non-fiction for authors.
And you're here at the writers' event here at Bath Central Library. And tell me about this book, Map of Shadows.
So when I first moved here in 2015, I used to walk past this map shop all the time. It was called Jonathan Potter's Map Shop. And one day I was walking past and I was looking in the window and I could see this ancient map. And I was like, what would happen if you could walk through that map? And what I then discovered, I got into cartography, heavily into cartography, and I found that there's lots of maps that don't actually match the physical world, that there are maps that people made of places that don't exist anymore, islands that disappeared, and mistakes on maps as well. And I was like, well, what would happen if all these things that were written off the map, or places where cities where we bulldoze and disappear in war and borders change, and what if all those places ended up in another world? So the book Map of Shadows, it opens in Bath, and the heroine, Sienna, gets left a map shop. Her grandfather dies in mysterious circumstances, and she's left this map shop, and then she finds that she can walk through maps, and that's the beginning of the adventure. It's a trilogy. It is an adult dark fantasy, but yeah, it's sort of inspired by ancient maps, and I think a lot of us are fascinated by those.
So is your brain always turned on to some sort of imaginative theme, what you can think of? Is this how you walk around in the world?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought everybody was like that, but it turns out they're not. I mean, no, I do. I wander around and I'm always having ideas. I see weird creatures in places, and I think of different ideas, and it's one of the most frustrating things, I think, as an author, is that there's always more ideas to write about, and as soon as you finish one book, you're like, now I can write this one, and now I can write that one. And so, yeah, I really love my job as a fiction author primarily, but I also do help other people, you know, with writing their books. So, but yeah, I think if you have that kind of brain and you love writing and you see ideas everywhere, then please, yes, get that into the world.
Now, you've got another book which has intrigued me called Pilgrimage. Tell me about that.
Yes, so I guess Pilgrimage started, it's a sort of midlife memoir, pandemic memoir as well, when we were shut in a lot. And I do travel a lot, but in this case, it was like, I can't travel, but I want to get out. So walking was one of the things we could do, right? And when I got COVID, which many of us did get COVID at some point, I was thinking, what would happen if I did die? What would I regret? And I always wanted to walk the Camino de Santiago. It was something I discovered in my, I guess, my late teens, when Paulo Coelho's book Pilgrimage came out back in the 90s, and I was like, I want to walk that walk. And then I always put it off, I put it off. And then when I was lying there with COVID, I was like, if I die, I'll be so annoyed that I didn't walk the Camino. It's one of those things I wanted to do. So I put that on my list, but of course then we couldn't. So I walked the St. Cuthbert's Way, which I believe you have also done, the Pilgrim's Way from London to Canterbury. And all of these together just gave me a sense of what it means to cross in the path of history and to walk in the steps of thousands of people for many, many years, and just gave me a lot of precious things to hold on to during a time of great change, both in my own life as a middle-aged woman, but also in the life of the world. And so when, with Pilgrimage, if people are feeling lost, if people are feeling untethered from the world, knowing that you're going to go from A to B, and that you get up and you walk along a map, and then you stop, and then you sleep, and then you get up, and then you walk. And this is just a great way to help you if you're struggling. And I was going through some mental health issues at the time, and the pilgrimages saved me, they really did. And this book, Pilgrimage, Lessons Learned from Solo Walking, Three Ancient Ways, because I went on my own. And if people are worried, I absolutely recommend it. You know, amazing times, difficult times, as you know. But yeah, it's just very worthwhile sometimes to just go for a really long walk.
Oh, it's lovely to share a similar passion with you. Thank you so much, Jo, for talking to me today.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thanks there to Jo Penn. Now, Bath is blessed with many independent bookshops, and one of its most beloved is Mr. B's on John Street. Set up in 2006, it has delighted visitors from far and wide. So I went over there to pick the brains of Sam Drew and get a list from him of the books set in Bath. Here he is. We're right at the bottom of Mr. B's Emporium of books, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights is the exhaustive name for me.
It's a fantastic name, isn't it? And I'm with Sam Drew, who listeners might remember from a walking podcast 2021.
I think so, yeah. Seems a while ago now, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're here today to think about writers who've used Bath in their books, and you've got a pile of books over there that you've kindly curated for us, but this is something that Mr. B's does, so just tell me a little bit about what you do here and what makes you in 2015 one of the Guardian's top 10 bookshops of the entire world.
So Mr. B's is a customer service focused bookshop, so the idea is that you can walk into the bookshop with no idea of what you want to buy, not necessarily any idea of what you're interested in. And you will be able to talk to a bookseller, so somebody whose entire passion is knowing about books, but also knowing how to talk to people. So eliciting something from you about what you might be interested in, whether it's a theme or a setting or something similar to a type of book that you've enjoyed before. And the idea is that you can get, you know, great recommendations for new authors and new titles,
which is something that's really important, because the choice of book titles to read is just overwhelming now, isn't there, with so many being published every week. How many do you and your colleagues get through every week, do you think?
There's probably 50 books being read every week, I would estimate, across the team. I'm a pretty light reader compared to my colleagues, mostly reading books to my seven-year-old at the moment, and lots of non-fiction. But I've got colleagues who read hundreds of books last year. My colleague Katrina, who curates lots of the sort of nature and travel books, read 200 last year. Got a colleague, Tom, who specializes in all kinds of literary fiction. Again, several hundred books a year.
It's extraordinary. So let's get into this pile, otherwise we'll never get through it. So what are we going to start with, Sam?
So I've got a few different categories of books here, Pommy. These are all books that I've used on paperback ramblers walks. So just to give you a really rough idea of what that was a walking book group where, instead of a traditional book group where we'd sit around a table and discuss, we'd go for a walk and discuss a book that we'd all read. And that allowed me to choose a real variety of books for a few different reasons. So some of the books would be authors who've lived in Bath, and we would read their book and maybe visit places that they'd lived or their haunts to give us some idea of how Bath's changed and how it may have inspired or infuriated those authors. So we've got people like Jane Austen, fairly well known, but also the Austrian author Stefan Zweig. I've got a couple of his books here. William Beckford, that interesting, controversial figure. We've also got books which are set in Bath, so not necessarily local authors, but people who've set novels either set in contemporary Bath or historical Bath. So we would go for a walk through some of the locations, some of the events in the book. And it's just a great way of approaching a book from another angle, giving you another appreciation of what the author's done. So I've got a couple of great titles I can tell you about here. The Frequency of Us by Keith Stewart. Absolutely amazing novel written by a brilliant journalist. Set in more or less contemporary Bath, and also a Bath in the Blitz. And I've got Laura Purcell, who does sort of gothic literature. Wrote a novel called The Shape of Darkness, set in, I think, Victorian Bath. And maybe the third sort of theme that I had for the book group was using Bath. It's got a great variety of landscape. So sometimes I would find an analogous landscape to something that's in a novel not set in Bath. So, for example, there are a couple of books we read which were set on water, like Penelope Fitzgerald's Offshore, which is all about a houseboat living community in London. So we read that novel and then went for a walk along the canal in Bath. Same for Elise Fowler's Hidden Nature, amazing candid travel memoir where she explored the Birmingham Canal Network over a period of a year or so during a crisis in her life. And we've also got brilliant travel writers like Nick Hunt, wrote a book called, he's written several books, but his latest travel book, Outlandish, is all about landscapes that seem to belong to a completely different period of time or a completely different continent, but are findable in Europe. So we had a walk where we, try and find a few analogous landscapes. And we've also done things like Colston Whitehead's Underground Railroad, when we walked through the two tunnels. So it's just finding some way of giving some link to the book.
That's a fantastic array of books you've outlined there. And we'll see how many we can talk about today. So where should we start?
Why don't we start with an incredibly famous resident of Bath? So you've talked to somebody, I gather, about Jane Austen, fairly well known, maybe slightly less well known, but would have been one of the most popular writers in the world when he was writing, Stefan Zweig. So, Austrian author, he was a novelist, playwright, journalist, a biographer, and as I say, he would have been very, very popular in the 30s. There was a big rekindling of interest in his work following the release of the Grand Budapest Hotel. You see that movie?
Yes, yeah. I did. I loved it.
So that's loosely based on a couple of his novellas primarily the post office girl. And he lived in Bath. You get a brilliant view from his house. And visiting his house and reading his work is a great way of understanding the development of the city as well. So he lived in a place called Rosemont in Widcombe. So it's on Rosemount Lane. And it would have offered him a view of green Widcombe Meadows, beautiful Georgian manors in the distance. And he wrote of Rosemount, "It was the first feeling of home he had for years, happy with his books and papers together." He fled Hitler's rise to power in Germany, leaving Austria for England in 1934. There's a story set here, a domestic thriller story called "Did He Do It?" It's narrated by the wife of a retired government official. They've spent their lives in the colonies and they've retired to a small village outside of Bath, which is very obviously Widcombe, is very obviously Rosemount Lane from reading the book. And they buy a plot of land near the banks of the Kennet and Avon Canal. And they have a cottage built there. Since there's not much canal traffic, they look forward to solitude. But of course, their peace doesn't remain intact for long. Somebody builds a house right next door. A young married couple moves in. And the wife is a quiet, self-contained, sort of private individual. But the husband is a sort of boisterous, gregarious kind of chap. And, you know, they've kind of wished for company and then, yeah, they regret wishing for it.
So that's Stefan Zweig.
Yeah.
Where shall we go next?
Well, why don't we try the second sort of theme I mentioned, books set in Bath. Why not? Very, very difficult to choose. Maybe I don't want to do a disservice to either author. I'll quickly tell you about both.
Yes.
Just for fun. All right. So the first of the two, there were lots that we did for the walk, by the way. Obviously, Bath's a sort of a rich inspiration for literature. But two of my absolute favourites. So The Frequency of Us by Keith Stewart. Really highly recommended novel. A clever drama, sort of a mystery, slightly romantic, quite emotional, but also brilliant book for highlighting what Keith Stewart calls the palimpsest of Bath. So this place that's been sort of reinvented over and over again. And as I say, Keith Stewart is a journalist. So all of his research, just brilliant. So that's set in, yeah, more or less the present day. The basis of the story is a woman called Laura, yeah, who's a social worker for this chap called Will Emerson. And Will Emerson lives in Bath and talks to anybody who will listen about a wife called Elsa Klein, who he claims was killed in the Blitz in Bath. Now, there's no evidence this woman ever existed, and Laura is charged with judging whether or not sort of Will can live on his own, or if something is wrong with his memory and his capacity to judge what's real and imagined. So it's partly a mystery story. So half of the story is Laura's relationship with Will, which is just lovely. And partly you're reading sort of over Laura's shoulder, Will's memoir of living in Bath during the Blitz. Lots of really interesting detail about the Francis Hotel being blown in half, for example. And the other amazing mystery, absolutely chilling, thematically fascinating. So Laura Purcell's The Shape of Darkness. Main character, a woman called Agnes Darken, who is a silhouette artist working from a shop in Orange Grove. And again, this really, really full of like interesting Bath history of a slightly different tone that you get in The Shape of Darkness. At the beginning of the book, somebody who she's taken a shade of, done a picture of, is murdered. And she seems to be the prime suspect. So she works with a spirit medium, this girl called Pearl, who lives on Walcott Street, whose day job is conducting seances and such. And Agnes works with Pearl to try and communicate with the dead, to try and prove that she's not the murderer. And it's very ambiguous. It's one of these wonderful novels where it seems like everything might be supernatural, and then it seems like everything might have a, you know, a sort of scientific cause. and it leaves you sort of, you know, moving between the two. Really, really engaging. But it's also got this really interesting theme. You know, think about Austin's work. You're often looking at lives of women who need to make a marriage. So not always making a marriage because it's somebody they're in love with, but often, you know, for the sake of for a livelihood, to support a family. Now, the Shape of Darkness, really interesting because you're looking at other forms of women's livelihood, women's work. So Agnes Darkin, an artist, Pearl, a spirit medium, both women, both supporting themselves and families with the work that they do, and their work threatened by modernity in both cases. So Agnes being an artist, we're looking at the beginning of the book, just this new interesting invention called photography. And it's this sort of, you know, maybe it's going to be a passing gimmick, maybe it's going to entirely put her out of business because people want to have their photograph taken, and what she does now seems old-fashioned. So she's threatened by modernity. And Pearl also, she absolutely believes that she has an ability, has a gift, and what she's doing is bringing sort of comfort to people. But we've got this sort of new scientific interest, and people are doubtful that she can do what she claims to do, and people want to test it to see if she can really do what she says, you know, and how she's doing it. So their livelihoods are threatened, often by interfering men, honestly.
Oh, Sam, these sound fantastic. Just to say, all the details of all the books you're talking about, we'll put in the show notes so everyone can find out more. And people can always come to the bookshop to get more recommendations. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today and opening up a whole new world of books and landscapes.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
On a final trip back to the library, we're going to meet Jenny Knight, who spoke to me about her book, Bath Through Time. And you're here at this writer's event. Tell me about the books that you've got. You've got a couple in front of you.
Yes, well, I've got one which is a Bath history tour, so that's a guide around Bath. And then my main one is Bath Through Time, which is a pictorial book about the past and photographs of the past and then photographs of the current situation. And it's a record, because a lot of the things have now actually disappeared from Bath. So it is quite a historical book. For example, there's various pubs around the place and they've been closing down. For example, there's the Porter and also the King William pub, which was really lovely. And they've all gone now, and that was in London Road. And so I've been going around Bath, taking pictures all the time. And so that's some of them are in my book.
So you're a photographer, you're a historian, you're a writer, and I think you're a broadcaster.
Yes, yes, I have done. And I'm doing a book at the moment, which I'm hoping to get published this year. And it's also, again, on Bath, but it's about the origins of Bath and King Bladud. I don't know if you've heard of him. Have
Tell you? Me about him.
Okay, well, he is the person, it's a mythology, but I believe actually it is true. And he founded Bath. His father was king, and he was meant to be taking over, but he developed leprosy. And so he was banished from the court, and so he became a swineherd. And he had a load of pigs, and they came across Bath, and they wallowed in this mud and this spring water, hot water. And when the pigs came out, they were cured of any inflictions that they might have. And so he thought, Bladud thought, right, I'm going to try this. So he went in and he was cured of his leprosy. So then he was able to go back and become king when his father died. But he never forgot Bath, and he actually built the first of the springs here. And then when the Romans came to Bath, then they developed the baths as we see them now, but on top of Bladud's spring.
That's a lovely story, and you're writing a book about that. I wish you well with your publications.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been lovely to meet you. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thanks to all who took part in the episode, and you can find links to all the items in the show notes as usual. Do email us with any suggestions or comments at info@bathscape.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. And please, please share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. For more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.